On today's program, Episcopal priest and author Cynthia Bourgeau joins us talking about her book, Love is Stronger Than Death, The Mystical Union of Two Souls. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. Welcome to the program. This powerful book, written by an Episcopal priest, tells of her intense relationship with Brother Raphael Robin, a 70-year-old Trappist monk and hermit. Both believed that a relationship can continue beyond this life, and here Cynthia Bourgeau describes her search for that connection before and after Robin's death. Deeply enriched by Bourgeau's knowledge of the teachings of G.I. Gurdjieff and of Christian mysticism, their vibrant, provocative, beautifully written story adds a profound new dimension to our understanding of human love and the possibility of survival beyond the grave. Regarding this book, Isabel Allende writes, "This is a most unconventional love story. Two aging individuals in search of God meet and immediately recognize the beloved in each other. Together they attain what they could not do alone. They discover the highest form of human love, a love that joins them as one soul and defies death. This is a spiritual book about human passion." Well, modern-day mystic, Episcopal priest, writer, and internationally known retreat leader Cynthia Bourgeau is the author of 8 books, including The Wisdom Jesus, Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening, and The Meaning of Mary Magdalene. She divides her time between solitude at her seaside hermitage in Maine and a demanding schedule traveling globally to teach and spread the recovery of the Christian contemplative and wisdom path. She's a founding director of both the Contemplative Society and the Aspen Wisdom School, and she joins us today from her beautiful retreat center in Maine. Cynthia Bourgeau, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Richard. Good to be here.
Well, it's an honor to have you on because one of the people that I follow and get his daily emails is Father Richard Rohr, and you've done some work with him.
Oh, yes. We are conspirators, collaborators on his living school.
Yes, exactly. That's where I've read a lot of things about you, but you've authored many, many books. But today we're talking about your book, Love is Stronger Than Death, which is actually now the 15th anniversary edition coming out.
Yeah, at least, I think. That's right, 15.
Yeah, and yeah. I love, in the new foreword of the book, I'm turning to that right now, which was written by Brother David Stendel Rast. Mm-hmm. The very first line, I think, just says it all, and that is, you are about to read a love story.
Yep.
And it's not your typical love story, is it?
Not a bit. But the world might be improved if there were more love stories like it.
Talk to us about this story. Talk to us, because this story, first of all, started later in your life. You were in your second marriage. You were out on the East Coast.
Yep.
And there's a 20-year age difference between you and the man you fell in love with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was just out of my second marriage, so mm-hmm. we can at least move it from that much of an active scandal zone. And that in part of my seeking discernment about getting out of a marriage that had been, began in emotionally abusive and went downhill from there, that I had come out for a time of really doing some spiritual formation and deep discernment and silence with the monks at St. Benedict's Monastery in Snowmass, Colorado. Mm-hmm. I knew the place quite well because I had already for the past 3 years or so been teaching Centering Prayer, and Snowmass there, as it's called, is the Mecca of that particular thing. So I came out to study and be with the monks and explore my own deepening attraction to the deep Christian contemplative path. Mm-hmm. And in the process of being out there, and actually even before I left, there was on this outside of my radar screen the hermit monk there at the community who made his living as a in the monastery as their plumber and electrician and occasional cowboy, and I knew from just the few conversations we'd had with him that this was a spiritual seeker of an entirely different order from most anything you find in Christianity. And during the time, during the couple of years after that, I began to discover how that was so, that he was a ardent spiritual seeker of the non-dual variety, really determined by all ways to fuse in his mind the kind of classic Roman Catholic Trappist mysticism with what he'd been reading of kind of mindfulness and spiritual awareness through the Gurdjieff work.
Yeah.
So we gravitated to each other because that was basically the same fusion that I was looking at. And we developed a deep friendship that I would say was 100% romance and 100% spiritual questing. And I think that finally what made it work was that was the balance for both of us. It was 100 and 100. Within the course of our relationship, there were days when it swung to 60-40 or 40-80. But on the whole, it was really predicated with the sense that this was a profound and wise spiritual seeker in the last years of his life. And I was desperately hungry on all levels, young woman seeking intimacy and spiritual transformation in about the same degree of intensity.
Yeah, we're talking about Brother Raphael Robin,
yeah,
who
right.
you met on that December 10th, 1990 day.
Yep.
And you called him, it wasn't Raphael.
Yeah, I called him Rafe, you know.
He
entered the monastery in Georgia, and when they gave him the monastic name, Brother Raphael, the way you pronounce it in Georgia is Brother Raphael. So he became Brother Raphael ever since.
Yeah. What was interesting about that first meeting, though, is that the conversations the both of you had just really, really took off. But what struck me was this. You wrote of the torrents of words and feeling that passed between us. I can remember only one sentence when he suddenly took both my hands in his and said, "It's all so simple, so very simple."
Yeah.
What did he mean by that?
Well, I think that really it's a speaking out of the unitive heart. It's not so much what he means and anything that you could download into a cognitive explanation. It's more like, that Kierkegaard, I think, said that the pure in heart is the one that wants one thing only. And when you want one thing only, it really becomes very, very simple, because the multiplicity and the every way, which wayness of our demands that usually are on us all the time just disappear. And it's all a straight shot toward what your heart is yearning for. And I think that what happened on that day is that we both, it was as if our kind of psychic fields opened and melted and just created a luminous space of understanding. And in that space, he just poured out from the straight of his heart what was the essence of what he was searching for and seeking for all his life.
Yeah, you mentioned that Rafe didn't live out of an ordinary consciousness. His awareness grew out of the mystical prayer that for 40 years had been central for his life. You also say that you both sensed keenly that the purpose of your time left together was, as Rafe put it, to forge a conscious connection that would endure from here to eternity. When he shared that, did you even have a glimmer of an understanding of what he was talking about or what he was feeling at the time?
Well, I certainly did, but again, it was at the level of the heart. You know, when people say, "I'll love you forever," it usually winds up meaning, "I love you very much." And you don't really understand about the forever bit until you get to try a little time beyond the grave. But I think we both had a sense that guided us through the minefields, that there was an element in here of what you might call cosmic service or cosmic transmission. And I don't want to overstate that because it sounds so, sort of grandiloquent. But Rafe was a very, very, one-of-a-kind spiritual seeker, the kind you find probably much more commonly on Sufi paths or Buddhist paths, that was just totally committed to the transformation of consciousness. And for various reasons, he'd lived his life a little bit in hiding. He'd never really led with that. And toward the end of his life, I think something in the cosmic harmonies decided to give him a boot in the pants because he possessed so much wisdom, so much, you know, it was ahead of its time. And one of the things I've seen in the 15 years that's ensued is that the world has sort of caught up a little with where he was at, all alone, as he did his journey in the 80s and 90s. But I think that there was some sort of figuring of tumbler lock somewhere in the cosmos and figured that I was probably the one who could comprehend a little bit of what he was trying to say and would eventually be able to figure out how to put it out there.
Mm-hmm. Did you know in that first encounter, I mean, you describe it, and there was a very profound connection. Did you feel that at all levels?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And both of you felt that?
Yeah, it was just like we opened up into a space. And I use the term sometimes in that book, the abler soul, which mm-hmm. is a term I borrowed from the English metaphysical poet John Donne, who talks about two souls, you know, that actually flow as one, and you might often say they come together and mm-hmm. form a space, a whole that's larger than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
And within that, all kinds of information and feeling gets transmitted just instantaneously.
You know, in many New Age circles, they might call what you experienced a twin flame relationship. Is that how you possibly would describe the relationship you even currently have with them?
Yeah. I mean, that would be one way, I think, within those kinds of terminologies. Mm-hmm. And we're just batting terminologies around.
Right.
But I think that what I love about Donne's sense of the abler soul is it's really a kind of an evolutionary principle that two come together to form some one larger thing that's at a, in some sense, a higher evolutionary level.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, two hydrogens and an atom and an oxygen coming together to form water. And so I think there's more of a sense of a kind of cosmic a fusion for some purpose. Twin flames is still twins, and it tends to talk about a kind of intensity of bonding on a horizontal level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The time that you two have shared together on Earth in the physical bodies while he was still, before his transition, share about what that relationship was like, given that he was also a hermit, a Trappist monk.
Well, it was a give and take.
Yeah.
And if I, you know, as I look back on it now from a 15 or 20 year perspective, I realize that we really were in different places in our life. And for me, it was still, I was in my 40s. I was very much in the grip of the twin flames, as we've just talked about it, wanting to find some other person with whom I could be absolutely intimate and who loved me and mm-hmm. And who was non-abusive in relationship. So my goals were still very much formed by a horizontal understanding of love.
Mm-hmm.
His was very much formed. He was at the end of his life, and he'd been a voracious spiritual seeker all his life. And his was formed by wanting to know what love means.
Mm-hmm.
And not in the romantic sense, but in the sense of true love being true because it points to true north, that it represents the highest and the most impartial in a being, and that it doesn't have an opposite.
Mm.
It's not affected by, you know, I'm mad at you and so I don't love you anymore.
Yeah.
It's a steady orientation of a soul that's capable of loving.
Yeah. My guest today is Episcopal priest and author Cynthia Bourgeault. We're talking about her book, Love is Stronger Than Death. This book actually is now the 15th anniversary edition. We have much more of this fascinating love story, but first we're going to go to a short break. This is Richard Brendon. back to the program. My guest today is Cynthia Bergeault, Episcopal priest, author, I would say contemporary mystic, contemplative. There's so much we could be talking about, actually, with all the other books that you have written. But this love story has fascinated so many people. By the way, when it first came out and through the years now, what has been the response to that book? What kind of questions do you get from people?
Well, I would say it parted the waters right from the start. I remember one of my spiritual teachers begged me, actually. He said, don't publish it. You know, he says, establish a reputation and get yourself safely known first, because this is really risky to lead with something that's so vulnerable. But, you know, and that was probably prudent advice in retrospect, but it did quickly part the waters, and there's some that wrote me off immediately. Where I got the strongest response was coming out of people that were mostly widows and widowers that says, you know, this is how it's been for me for 15 or 20 or 30 years, but I would never share it with anybody because I didn't want to be thought crazy. So it's brought deep, deep recognition and gratitude from people that have been there.
Yeah.
And as 15 years have passed, I would say more and more people are getting on that side.
Yeah. Rafe liked to call your relationship the experiment.
Yeah.
I thought that was cute.
Yeah.
It truly was, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it was. He was always a seeker in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And he realized that his wounds around love were a big agenda that was getting in the way of his complete, you know, transformation in God.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was partially because we had this wonderful graced space between us so that we could be totally kind of intimate and vulnerable and honest with each other, that we really, both of us, got to work through a lot of stuff that that had been just lurking there under the surface like sharks in the water.
Yeah.
And when he died, I was just shocked that it was over for me in terms of those issues. And I would never have expected, and it's really taken me 15 years of living into it to realize just how over it was, but that I, who had kind of been into what some people call serial monogamy up to that point, and I myself had figured that when Rafe, when Rafe and I, our earthly term was over, I would quickly go and pick up another soulmate.
Mm-hmm.
But in 15 years, nearly 20 now, there's been no such temptation in that direction, and the agendas around loneliness and the agendas around intimacy are all just vanished. It's full is full.
You just shared an interesting word. There was no temptation.
Yeah.
To do that. Why would you use that word?
Well, that's a good question, Richard. You know, the old Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation.
Mm.
I guess I would say that temptation in us generally grows out of an inner dividedness.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing that's there to tempt, that part of you wants something and part of you wants something else. And in my former kinds of life and love, that part of me saw myself as strong and free and saying something important on the spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me was a very, very needy and scared little girl. And so that part was always, could easily be hooked by anyone who came smiling down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And after Rafe left the planet, there didn't seem to be any needy little girl there anymore.
Talk about when he died, because you both had such a profound connection. Somewhere in your book, you even write the time. It was 11:26 p.m. It was a heart attack. He died swiftly. But you wrote, at home asleep, I came bolt awake. You just knew.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know what I knew when
came
bolt awake.
Right.
And then it was in retrospect, I put the pieces together. And then I came awake one time else in the night at 3:30, which was just about the time they discovered his body.
Mm-hmm.
He died in the monastery washroom.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there was a sudden fear, and then this strong sense that I recognized as kind of signature Rafe saying, it's okay, go back to sleep. So I didn't know anything about it until I went down to the monastery the next morning for the early morning services and saw a note on the door that from the guest master that said, "Dear retreatants, Brother Raphael died early this morning." And I remember parsing it out, kind of numb and in shock, "Brother Raphael." And I remember my first thought is, "Oh, well, I guess I don't have to go run after him and find out where he is today."
Mm-hmm. The connection was so profound, and both of you were so intuitive that you even write that both of you had a sense something like that might happen way before it happened.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about it for 3 months in advance, sort of talking around it.
Yeah.
He had had an infection which landed him in the hospital about, 3 to 4 months before he died, landed him in intensive care. And he had taken that time in his own kind of prophetic and visionary way to really come face to face with the ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
And without really knowing chapter and verse, he knew. And I could see by what he was doing that fall, he was very systematically cleaning things up and tailing things down. And there was no real medical reason for this kind of a trajectory. But there was that deeper knowing, and I kind of knew right along with it.
Mm-hmm. What was, share your experience that you had during the wake, because you too were doing somewhat of a dance during his own wake, too.
Yeah, well, it was the most remarkable experience I think I've ever had. I almost didn't go to it. That I thought, well, who needs to look at a body laid out on a flatbed in a church? But something made me go anyway, and then at the end of the services, we all sort of formed a line to walk past him and pay our final respects. And as I walked past, it was as if something moved, and it was real enough that it made me whip my head around and look again to see. It was like something jumped and passed, and I looked and no, it wasn't at the physical level. But it was so vivid and so powerful that I realized that somebody was still there and that neither one of us was going to go anywhere that night.
Yeah, yeah. My guest today is Episcopal priest, author, contemplative Cynthia Bourgeault. We're talking about her beautifully written book. It came out about 15 years ago. There's an anniversary edition out right now called Love is Stronger Than Death, The Mystical Union of Two Souls. I'm Richard Brendan. We'll have much more of this, but first a short break.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Goddess Mountain Naturals crafts quality salves and balms intended to aid in healing and rejuvenation of the skin and body through properties provided by nature. The various salves help to moisturize your skin, soothe itching caused by bug bites and poison ivy. These salves have been found to ease pain from sore muscles and tendons and aid in the healing of cuts and scrapes. These are remedies that have been used for thousands of years. For more information, you can visit www.goddessmountain.com. That's goddessmountain.com.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. It's a joy to have on today's show Cynthia Bourgeault, Episcopal priest, author. We're talking about her book, Love is Stronger Than Death, The Mystical Union of Two Souls. It's this beautiful cosmic dance, really, between Cynthia and Rafe, or Brother Raphael. Robin passed away many, many years ago now. I'd like to ask you a question. When you guys had your relationship, I guess I read somewhere in preparing for this that you practiced sort of a radical self-abandonment, which in some spiritual circles have been called the fifth way. Can you describe what that is, what that means?
Well, the fifth way really spins off of a term that was invented by the spiritual teacher Gurdjieff, the fourth way. And the fourth way is the way of the conscious human being, and it's a kind of way of moving on to transformation, to what I think nowadays we would call most commonly enlightenment or a state of more enlightened being, by mindfulness, by conscious awakening. So that's the fourth way, as Gurdjieff coined it many, many years ago. So one of his students, who was also a student of medieval, you know, love poetry and the troubadours and all that, coined the term the fifth way, which is simply conscious love, the path of conscious awakening practiced with a partner.
Mm-hmm.
And while the term is not that well known, certainly the quantity is. If you just call it conscious love, everybody has some glimmer of it. But it's allowing the jostle of personalities that always comes in intimate relationship, along with the yearning and aspiration for full awakening, and a sense that the beloved awaken fully, not just you, but your beloved too, that these things provide kind of grist for the mill for a very, very rapid working through your karmic deformations, if you want to call them that, your issues, your agendas, your stopping points. So it's throwing both of yourselves onto the fire, as it was, burning up your own false selves and entitlement and self-justification in order to fuse out of it this abler soul who can really operate in higher spiritual realms.
We're talking about this profound mystical union you had with this beautiful man. I shared earlier that in metaphysical circles, some might call New Age circles, they call that twin flame. But where you might differ from some of that teaching is you don't really hold to reincarnation as a belief, do you?
No, not really. That because I think that it's not about getting to come back to this planet in another life. It's really about forming a different kind of conscious unit whose service, as Rafe used to call it, is in the conscious circle of humanity. Which is kind of, you might call it, a band of grace surrounding the planet, consisting of conscious souls no longer in their bodies and conscious aspirants still in their bodies, sort of reaching across and touching each other and forming a bridge between the worlds.
Yeah, yeah. What you and Rafe share today, him being on the other side, is what some have called, I suppose, a sabbatic and conversation of the heart that continues to this day. Can you share with our listeners what that's like?
Yeah, well, I would say that the first thing that I was alluding to earlier in the conversation is there's a sense of fullness.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a sense, a lot of people are saying, don't you get lonely? And I say, why? You know, because there's a sense that what always characterized Rafe is still here, the quality of his essence and presence, by which I knew him when I saw his old car driving down the driveway. same quality of aliveness and personhood.
Mm.
And so for me, what was remarkable was, first of all, I began to be able to teach and say and know things in a way that I didn't know before.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about channeling. I'm not talking about a specific piece of information or things that I'm supposed to say being given to me.
Mm-hmm.
There's just that somehow I have access to not only what he knew, but his continuing efforts, his continuing aliveness in knowing it.
Hmm.
So there's a sense of an enlargening of my boundaries without knowing quite what's in this larger boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there's some sense of dynamic conversation, you know, that it's not a one-way street. I don't simply sit here and receive information from him, but I sense that the quality of my own efforts and work and way of life that's fallen to me is in some sense reverberating in whatever sphere he's particularly in as well.
Yeah. There's a touching part in your book towards the end. It's called A Wedding Sermon, where you had the joy and honor of officiating at your daughter's wedding.
Yeah. And they've passed the 15-year mark now.
Share what that was like, because clearly what you shared was influenced by the love you were still engaged with Rafe.
Oh, I'm so glad you noticed that. That's quite insightful and sensitive. You know, basically, I just went back to the old quote from from St. Paul in Corinthians. It says, you know, love bears all things, hopes all things, you know, endures all things, and interpreted it to them from the point of view of this fifth way path or conscious awakening as a path that they could follow to turn their own relationship into, you know, into a real drama and you know, sacred drama of becoming for both of them. And that's what I learned from Rafe, and that's what I'm still working, you know, in the course of almost any relationship. If you don't bring in that element of conscious awakening, it tends to run from, you know, romantic infatuation, and then all of a sudden stress hitting when you have jobs, when you have children, and distancing, and finally midlife crises. So that's love on the horizontal axis, and it's by and large doomed. But if you can begin to develop this thing that Rafe taught me, where you consciously yearn for each other's being and become the handmaidens of each other's awakening, not for personal enlightenment, but for cosmic service.
Yeah.
Then you have something to recoup from. You have a point of reference, a jointly fused witnessing presence that allows you to adjust and grow and roll with the punches, much more so if it's just personality to personality.
You shared a very beautiful phrase there, handmaidens for each other's awakening. I love that.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I'm remembering that John Donne quote that he says in his one poem, I think it's called The Ecstasy, when love for one another so inter-inanimates two souls, the abler soul, which thence doth flow, defects of loneliness controls. So it's this love for one another inter-inanimating, a lovely term, two souls, and essentially forming a higher unit that you can draw on as you move through the crises of life in the world.
Absolutely. Well, I, like everyone else, love a great love story, and we're going to have more of this conversation. You're listening to The Richard Brendon Show. The book is Love is Stronger Than Death, A Mystical Union of Two Souls. It's a memoir, really, of Cynthia Bergholtz and Raphael's beautiful dance that still continues to this day. We'll have much more of this inspiring story, but first, here's a word from one of our sponsors.
Richard Brendon, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendon. It's a joy to have Cynthia Bergholtz on today. We're talking about her book, Love is Stronger Than Death. It first came out about 15 years ago. It's now reissued, and I'm so glad it is, because now new readers are beginning to be introduced to it, and I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. I want to ask you something, Cynthia. In the book, you discuss four building blocks of soul work beyond the grave: reunion of souls, building the second body, the vow, and working in the wonders. I'm wondering if we can cover each one of those just a little bit.
Sure.
To let our listeners know.
Sure. You can prompt me a little bit, because I don't have the book directly in front of me.
So first, reunion of souls. What does that mean? What does that entail?
Well, it really means that we recognize each other from a very, very deep way. From a place beyond just sort of linear space-time causality, and realize that which existed before time is not terribly disrupted when death changes the format.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then building the second body.
Well, the second body, is referred to in almost all the spiritual traditions by different names, the wedding garment, the etheric body, the inner being. But there is a deep sense that there is something inside our physical body that's much more fluid and subtle, and that is of its own nature timeless. Mm. Rafe used to say to me, you must find that in you which already lives beyond death and begin to live out of it now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of selfhood that is deeper than just our egoic and personal selfhood as we experience it. Some people would tend to equate it with a witnessing self, and I think that's probably a close equivalent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But as you begin to learn to live out of that, rather than gratifying and appeasing your ego, but really growing this through the quality of your conscious work, something begins to stabilize in you, which is really it's like you've transposed your identity to this thing in you which is already beyond time.
Yeah, yeah. The third building block is the vow.
Yep. The conscious commitment to form an abler soul, which is basically to lay down one's life for one another and to, like any other evolutionary unit, to come together with no backing out, to exchange a certain degree of personal autonomy at one level in return for muchly increased function at another level.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then finally, the working in the wonders.
The commitment to live in the world, and for the ones still here in the planet, which happens to be me at this point, to continue to grow and develop and be a part of the majesty and the profundity of this world, sort of harvesting it like a bee harvesting honey, that it may be a gift for the larger, abler soul of both of us.
Hmm. Do you talk to him every day, like verbally, out loud?
Or is it more? I wouldn't say we chatter out loud. It's more like breathing.
Yeah, just always aware of his presence. And
yeah, and occasionally there'll be very, very sharp things. There was the time, last fall or so when I got into a little mess and I found myself saying, Rafe, help.
You know,
quite miraculously, the mess disappeared. but we don't do that as a measure, of course. I realize I'm supposed to be a little bit self-reliant. But there is a deep sense we're in it together.
Mm. Yeah.
And I would say what the 15-year anniversary of the book really brings is a 15-year track record. So that what I'm saying, that I don't think there's a single thing in there that I would take back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the more I live into it, the more I find that it's corroborated itself in my own life, certainly, and in other people's lives who can see it and can see the fruits in it in what I've been and done.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It is an amazing story. It truly is a beautiful love story. And I think it really is radical in the sense that it opens up love in even a deeper way, love carrying on in the afterlife. And
yeah.
You showed great courage when so many were encouraging you not to write this book at that time, for writing it.
Yeah, I don't know whether to call it courage, desperation, or what. But there was a sense that it needed to be heard.
Yeah.
And part of what was driving me was we were right back then in the late 90s in the grip of this whole grief counseling thing that basically was telling everybody to cut it off, bring it to quick closure, get a new relationship, get back into life.
Mm-hmm.
And I just knew that wasn't the instruction for everybody.
Yeah. You have been committed most of your life, as well as Rafe, to the contemplative life, centering prayer. A lot of our listeners are familiar with those terms. Do you find there's a renewed interest these days in those kind of practices?
Oh, yeah, widely.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
Well, there's a number of things, and I would be happy if my book and my teaching has been a little bit of what's really a growing stream.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, on the most practical level, there's now this huge burgeoning body of data coming from neuromeditation that just really documents the effects on the brain and the whole overall health and balance of a person by embarking on these disciplines.
Yeah.
for me, and then I think that as we've moved in great, wonderful leaps along a path to interspiritual sharing in the world between the contemplatives of all the great religious streams, we really are beginning to pull out a model of what a more conscious human being looks like, what this kind of person can do. And there's a growing ascent coming up again from all the traditions that these kinds of skills and sensitivities and adaptations are really non-negotiable for the life of our planet. The kind of ego, individual autonomy, equating freedom with my freedom to choose what I want and rape the world as I want, is just no longer compatible.
Mm-hmm.
We really have to learn to pull together as a higher evolutionary unit. And the contemplative paths have the skills, and they have actually the neurology. The practice changes the way the brain and the heart is wired to permit a greatly expanded sense of belonging to the planet, to all sentient beings, and to God.
Yeah. And to be able to be more aware and to fall in love again with the earth, to have a reverence for the earth and all the creatures on this planet, which is something I'm very passionate about. And I'm going to borrow a few quotes from you from your book, Centering Prayer and Inner Awakening. You write, "With a break from the usual hurly-burly of your life, you have time to draw inward and allow your mind to meander." And that's really a lot of what that is. It's a time to just stop.
Yeah. Well, Wraith stopped so strongly that for 40 years he was a hermit.
Yeah.
And it's not the stereotype that's put on it at all of running away from the world and letting the world stew in its own juices. But so many of the great contemplatives of all traditions have realized that this collected, contemplated, non-task-oriented energy is an energetic force in its own right, and that it has profound kind of cumulative effects, like a great grace bank, in being available to soften the world and bring a deeper kind of wisdom and intelligence and harmony to a world that's way too metal to metal.
The hospice work that I have done in the past as a chaplain taught me so much about the power of presence. Just being with that one. Words were not necessary. And in that book, you also quoted somebody that I have always loved to study, and that's the 16th century mystic John of the Cross. And he said, "Silence is God's first language."
Yes.
I love that quote.
Yeah, exactly. And so as we work in those bands, we really do bring a kind of healing energy to the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we grow more conscious ourselves and more collected and less vulnerable to all the outside pressures clamoring at us, we walk on the world bestowing a kind of grace of collectedness and inclusivity. And I think these things are desperately needed for our planet today.
And before we close, can you share a little bit about the Contemplative Society organization?
The Contemplative Society was a group I founded in British Columbia right after Rafe had left the planet, and I was sort of spit out into the universe to begin to make this all bear fruit. And so some wonderful people in and around Victoria, British Columbia, invited me up there to form a network that would include people that were practicing centering prayer and Christian meditation and Christian Vipassana. Any people that were meditating in a general Christian milieu,
mm-hmm.
to come together for joint teaching and for joint retreats and quiet work.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first time that anybody knew that we'd put together that kind of an organization, because the various meditation paths in Christianity have very, very kind of well-organized membership organizations. But there's nothing that's putting them under a greater umbrella.
Yeah.
So we were the first Christian contemplative umbrella.
For people who'd like more information about your work and where you might be in the world, is that the best website to point them to?
Yeah, just www.contemplative.org. And it has a bit of what's going on in my wake and in British Columbia. I moved back to Maine in about 2004. But... the group continues. It's another thing that's celebrating its 15th anniversary. And they continue to do their wonderful thing, making contemplative training and practice available to people in the whole Pacific Northwest. And it's also the place where my blog and my website are there, and you can buy audios that I've made for the Contemplative Society and other places, and link to all sorts of things that's going on, including my calendar.
Mm-hmm. There's something about that number 15, isn't there?
Ah, God. It's 2015.
Exactly. Oh, my gosh. You have authored 8 books. I'm sure there's more coming. The one we're focusing on now, which certainly has rocked my world, as it has so many through the years, is Love is Stronger Than Death, The Mystical Union of Two Souls, a beautiful read. Cynthia Borjall, it's been a joy to have you on today's program.
Thank you, Richard. You've been a great interviewer.
Blessings to you, and I look forward to having you back someday.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Next book.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Cynthia.
Okay, thank you, Richard. Uh-huh.
I so enjoyed my interview with Cynthia, and that is actually a beautiful love story. Again, the title is Love is Stronger Than Death, The Mystical Union of Two Souls. A good read. I was reading Hafez and Rumi poetry this past week, and I came across this Hafez poem, and I thought was very appropriate since this theme today seems to be about love, and it's called You're It. Hafez writes, God disguised as a myriad things and playing a game of tag has kissed you and said, You're it. I mean, you're really it. Now it does not matter what you believe or feel, for something wonderful, major league wonderful, is someday going to happen. Translation by Daniel Ladinsky. I'll have some closing thoughts, but first, here's a great song from social change artist Michael Fronte. Don't let it go.
must be strong for me. I'll be strong for you. Just be strong for me. I'll be strong for you. Just be strong for me. Don't let it go. Don't let it go. Don't let it go.
Don't let it go.
Don't let it go. Oh, don't let it go. Oh, don't let it go. Oh, don't let it go. Don't let it go.
The Sufi poet Rumi has said that love is a purifying fire. Love comes into the dark places where we used to hide our fear and our shame. It burns and consumes everything except itself. No untruth can stand its heat. And as the flame of love becomes a roaring fire, we bring a new energy and attitude toward our lives. We begin to live in the light of our own self-forgiveness. We begin to live in the warmth of our own compassion. Our resistances are dissolved like hard metal in a smelting furnace. Our ego agendas are annihilated. We begin to build a new world on the planet. You see, the work of love is calling, and all our gifts are needed. This new world will be based on acceptance and love, not fear and control. Love is so great, it cannot be contained. The love we often seek outside of ourselves is already within. So feel the warmth of that love as it already abides in you, because that's the presence of love. And there is no place where this love is not. It's truly a holy presence in our hearts. It flows like a great river into the ocean of life. Yet even the ocean can't contain it. The past and the future have no existential validity. Past and future are just stories we invent to create safety and predictability in our lives. We get lost in our stories, and we spend our lives defending them. And in so doing, we create a very limited experience of life. The alternative is to let your experience be what it is in any moment. Just allow life to unfold on its own timetable, in its own unique way. That way, you stop trying to take charge of your life, and you stop closing the door to possibilities that actually abound all around you. And each moment is fresh. Each moment is new. Each moment is innocent, spontaneous, and you're called to dance with it. Now, if we attempt to direct this cosmic dance, we're bound to be frustrated. So it's a little time for humility here. Why would we take on the direction of the wind and the motion of the stars? It's easier and more effective to allow ourselves to be swept up the current of life than trying to engineer its direction. It's been my experience that one who tries to push the river will usually fall in kicking and screaming. We're not here to push the river or even try to hold it back. We're here to sit under the oak tree on the riverbank until the river calls us, and when it does, to surrender to the current and let it take us where it will. There are greater forces at work here. May we trust them, and let us go into that trust. So stay open to the presence of love in your heart. Breathe and dwell in the heart. Fully inhabit the moment and open to its abundance. It's our return to the garden. Ah, it's our return to innocence. It's our return to our original nature. Somebody that Cynthia does a lot of work with is Father Richard Rohr. And Richard Rohr has written, "The soul needs living models to grow. And quite precisely, we need exemplars with the expansive energies of love. People who are eager to love change us at the deeper levels. They alone seem to open the field of both mind and heart at the same time. When we're in this different state, and that's what it is, we find ourselves open to directions or possibilities we would never allow or imagine after that point. In closing, I want to share something out of this book. It's the afterword that Cynthia wrote regarding her love affair, which is still continuing with Raphael, who she calls Rafe. She writes, "My hope is that couples reading this book will be encouraged to recognize the eternal elements in their relationships and prepare in the time of their physical life for the possibility of continuing the relationship beyond the grave if the invitation is extended. For those not so called, my hope is that this book may help them to be more compassionate with those who are, and for those readers who are outright skeptical, to suggest that at that tricky junction where spiritual yearning and human desire suddenly meet in the person of a human beloved, there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy. In conclusion, I can only say that I accept full responsibility for telling a story that belongs equally to one no longer in the flesh, particularly inasmuch as he was a monk, and of all monks, the most private. My sense is that he's a willing participant in this project. I recognize part of my own circular logic and will rise or fall on the strength of its own truth. I'd like to ask forgiveness of those most closely affected, his monastic brothers and his family, if I have inadvertently tarnished the memory of a man who was a dedicated spiritual seeker, and of others who were close to him, as if I seemed to imply that the part of his life that I shared in any way displaces their own. Rafe and I certainly never expected to be called into this kind of relationship. We both sensed all along that it was more of a matter of being entrusted to each other than of falling in love. But having accepted the call to love one another and walk together the final leg of Rafe's human journey, we did our best to honor it and discover its truth. He will always prefer to call our partnership the experiment. This book is another chapter in its ongoing unfolding." Well, it was a joy to have Cynthia Bergeau on the program, and I want to thank you for joining us today as well. And by the way, we're discontinuing our Blog Talk Radio feed in a short time, so please subscribe to the Dying to Live podcast via iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Links to the podcast subscription pages are available on the Richard Brendon website, which is richardbrendon.com. And that's today's program. Our engineers, Aaron Duvall, production coordinator Angel Richardson. I'm Richard Brendon. We'll catch you next week.